Thank you for the invitation. So yeah, it's always a pleasure to be here. And today I want to talk about this work that appeared this summer with Oriana Magoriano, who was my PhD student and now he's left the field, sadly for us, and thankfully for him. He's making better money in London. So we want to consider 4D quantum field theories today. And the key questions we are after is something that many of us have been thinking about over the last few years is what is the global form of the quantum field theory, right? And given QFT with a, if you can choose a global form, so with a specific global form, then we will call that a absolute theory. So very roughly speaking, if you think about 4D gauge theories, the global form is the form of the gauge group instead of just the Lie algebra that you would use to write the Lagrangian. So the basic example, which is the examples I will look in much detail today, is if you have a SU2 gauge theory, pure Yang-Mills theory, versus the SO3 gauge group. So of course, the Lagrangian is the same, the Yang-Mills Lagrangian, but the two theories differ through their spectrum of line operators in that case. Or alternatively, if you just do the path integral over arbitrary four manifolds, then you might get different answer for different groups because you're summing over different bundles. So in general, for this kind of question about the global form, what this amounts to is really to have a completely precise understanding of the symmetries of the system. And of course, that's the place where I could have 5 pages of citations because certainly the FTH community has been considering this question again, and other communities did also, what goes under the name of generalized symmetries and categorical symmetries and so on. So what is the general notion of symmetry in a quantum field theory? In QFT, the global form of the theory for our purpose will be just determined by the maximal set of mutually local line operators, following this, in particular, this famous paper by Aaron Easterberg and Tachikawa 10 years ago. I will review that in a moment. But for instance, if we have the SU2 Yang-Mills theory, we have at least two types of line operators you can consider. You have the Wilson lines of spin lambda over 2. So that will be the usual trace of the holonomy in some representations of the gauge group. But we also have magnetically charged lines, so the TOF lines, which correspond to monopoles of charge here, the minimal charge allowed, let's say, by the Lie algebra. In that case, it's also an integer. Lambda m. And in general, TOF line and Wilson line need not be mutually local, but if you have the minimal charge, you might incur a sign if you try to commute the line in some canonical quantization. So mutually local line will mean that precisely this sign here, I mean, here in that case, lambda e lambda m between the Wilson line and TOF line should be even, then you have no problem. And you have a well-defined quantum field theory. So I want to consider theories with L supercharges today, so 4D n equal 2. And in that case, we know that we have we have a Coulomb branch of vacua, which will be some VEV of some Coulomb branch operators, some certain RVPS operators. Due to supersymmetry, if you think about what will be the low energy effective field theory in flat space on the Coulomb branch, it's fully determined by the Lagrangian is fully determined by a single holomorphic function, the prepotential, that depends on the low energy photon. So A here would be some scalar in some low energy vector multiplet. And Seber-Newton, 30 years ago, famously solved for this prepotential exactly. So that means non-perturbatively. So the prepotential has a one-loop exact piece, but then you have a sum over instantons if you think of it as from a weakly coupled point of view. And so we will review that for the pure SU2, but this is precisely the so-called Seber-Witten solution. And the main thing I want to explain today is, in fact, is how the spectrum of line is encoded in the Seber-Witten solution for rank one theories. So pure SU2 is the simplest rank one theory, asymptotically free, and then there are a few more examples in 4D. And there are very interesting examples which were part of our motivation if you consider 6D or 5D theories compactified to 4D, and then think of it again in terms of Seber-Witten theory. So in some sense, what I want to do today is very simple, is to read together a few papers from 30 years ago and from 10 years ago. So the 30 years ago paper are the two papers of Seber and Witten. The other one is the Reading Between the Lines paper from 2013. And then closely related, there is a notion of higher form symmetries that acts on line operators in this case. So the generalized global symmetry paper also from 9 years ago. And if you look at those three papers, one thing they have in common, they have one author in common, and you also see that they use the same ARVAC template from the last 30 years. All right. So the Seber-Witten solution packages the low energy effective action here for my SV2 sparing mill theory in terms of the so-called Seber-Witten curve, which is really a one parameter family of elliptic curves over the U-plane, the Coulomb branch. And the basic questions I'm after is that if you look at the SO2 gauge theory, so really the SU2 gauge group, then there is the Wilson line that is allowed, which is the fundamental Wilson line, say, or Wilson lines of any spin, and they are charged under one form symmetry that gives you this sign in this case. So can we see this one form symmetry from the Seber-Witten curve? That's the first question we'll answer, and then if you know how the one form symmetry is encoded in the low energy description of Seber and Witten, then we should know how to actually gauge the one-form symmetry. And gauging the one-form symmetry, that means considering going from the SU2 to the SO3 gauge theory in the UV. But again, how do we see that in the infrared description? So the short answer is that we will need to consider the rational section of the Seber-Witten curve, and this is the overall picture in the Super Young Mills SU2 case. I'll come back to this picture in detail in 30 minutes or 40 minutes. But the one thing that we may be jumping ahead is that we will have to distinguish between the curve in the middle, which is what we'll call a relative curve, which is for the relative, what people these days might call the relative QFT, and then the absolute form of the theory are the black. So here, this blob here is a Coulomb branch, and then there is a particular elliptic vibration on top of this Coulomb branch, particular Seber-Witten curve. All right, any questions about the introduction? So let's start by just reviewing this well-known story in the SU2 case. So let's consider the case of the SU2 theory then. So that's something first studied, I think, in detail in the paper of Gaiotto, Moore, and Naisky in 2010. And so we know that the SU2 is just a double cover of SO3. Where the Z2 is the center of SU2. So in that case, just if you think of 2x2 matrix, just 1 and minus 1. So for any 4D gauge theory, then we can consider dynamic lines for any electric, in my notation, sorry, magnetic LM and electric charges, which would be what we will call the magnetic weight lattice and the ordinary weight lattice of the Lie algebra, say. And well, here for SU2, those are one-dimensional lattice. But remember that the weight lattice here would be of SU2 is what I would call the weight lattice also of the algebra itself. But the weight lattice of SO3 is a smaller; it's twice smaller, just from the fact that in SO3 I can only consider representations of integer spins. And conversely, the magnetic weight lattice of the SU2 algebra is the same as the magnetic weight lattice of the SO3 group. So this is the minimal magnetic charge or bundle on the sphere that we can consider for SO3. And there are twice as many such bundles as the SU2 bundles. Right? Only the SO3 bundles with a vanishing stability class can then uplift to SU2 bundles. Now, to have a consistent quantum field theory, I need that the spectrum of line that then carry magnetic and electric charges are mutually local, which means that their direct pairing here is 0 mod 2. And then considering this condition, then we can look at all the possible electric and magnetic charge. And so there are three solutions. One is when you have only any integer electric charge, but then even magnetic charge in this normalization. That would be the SU2 theory. There is one where you do the converse, so you take only the even electric charge, so integer spins, but in any magnetic charge, then it's what is called the SO3 plus theory, because there is also a third solution where you just take any integers. The condition is just that then the sum of the electric and magnetic charges is even. And in fact, these two assignments of line operators are both SO3 gate series, and you can go continuously from one to the other by changing the theta angle in that case, extending the theta angle first, as you should do in SO3 from having a 4 pi range. But then if you go from theta to theta to plus 2 pi, then you would go from the SO plus to SO3, SO3 plus to SO3 minus theories and vice versa. Now, in any pure gate theory, in 4D, in this case, I can always consider also the defect group of the of lines that even before I think about what global form of the gauge group in this case I have. So the defect group are just the lines that cannot be screened. They're generated by the group of lines that are the one that cannot be screened by dynamical particles. And in the SO3 case, essentially all the dynamical particles, both in the UV and non-perturbatively, as we will see in a second, they've even charged my normalization, so integer spin. But even charged for the low energy point of view, for the low energy U1. And so that means that, there will be a consistent set of lines that cannot be screened just because there is nothing in the theory that can screen them. So for instance, for the SU2 theory, we can have the Wilson lines and it cannot be screened because there is no fundamental quarks in the theory. And so if we have this choice what I mean to say here is that given the defect group, you could choose then equivalently to what we just said in the previous slide, you could choose a consistent set of lines that is equivalent to choosing a Lagrangian subgroup of this Z2 plus Z2 defect for the SU2 case, defect group, sorry. And so there are again three subgroups of Z2 plus Z2 Lagrangian subgroups. And if you take the first choice, 0, 1, is just when you have just picked the Wilson lines. If you pick the TOF line instead, is the 1, 0. And if you, the diagonal one will be you have this dynamic line in the spectrum, which are allowed, and this is the SO3 minus. And those are the basic lines that are charged and under a symmetry, which is the one-form symmetry of the theory. This is the ordinary center symmetry of an SU2 theory. This is the magnetic dual one-form symmetry, and similarly for the diagonal case. All right. So in the Sebastian perspective, in the infrared, we are interested then in the low energy effective action on the Coulomb branch, which is parametrized by this operator in terms of the UV parameters. That's just the trace of pi squared. And so the low energy dynamics then is written in terms of low energy photons. And we want to know how this low energy, so the prepotential depends on where you are on the Coulomb branch. Really, the key things that enters the flat space Lagrangian is just the second derivative of the prepotential, tau, which is then the low energy, the effective gauge coupling of the photon, right? So the effective gauge coupling, yes. Now, because supersymmetry, we have all this prepotential structure and the fact and this special geometry, which physically is the fact that I can define an infra magnetic dual. I get thing. Did I review that? No, I didn't review that. But in the infrared, of course, if I have just a photon, there is also electromagnetic duality of a U1 gauge field that goes all the way to Maxwell and Heaviside. If I'm sitting somewhere on the Coulomb branch, I don't know if I'm looking at the electric photon or the magnetic dual. It's up to me, really. So there is this electromagnetic duality ambiguity. And so if we have a photon, we can also define the dual photon and at the level of the path integral. So that's a non-trivial transformation of the path integral, but that corresponds to essentially a Legendre transform of the prepotential. If we knew all the photon and the dual photon kind of depends on where you are on the Coulomb branch, then you have everything and you can compute. You can compute the tau, which is what we're after. So what we're after is really now some function A and A dual as a function of the Coulomb branch. So some section on the Coulomb branch. And what Seber and Newton did is assume that those objects, the physical period A and A dual, can be taught as physical as periods of some auxiliary objects, the Seber-Witten curve. And then the key point is that then dA dual dA here will be the effective QH coupling, but it's identified and with the modular parameter of the empty curve of the Seber-Witten curve. Right. So again, this is auxiliary construct. The good thing is that the imaginary part of tau is positive geometrically here, and as it should be physically, because it's the imaginary part is the inverse gauge coupling. So let me then remind ourselves so we're all on the same page of a few facts about elliptic curves. So there will be a few slides of purely mathematical notation. So at rank one, then the Seber-Witten geometry, what I call the Seber-Witten geometry, is just the one-parameter family of elliptic curves. So it's a elliptic vibration over pi 1, the compactified Coulomb branch. I mean, it's a Coulomb branch. It's not compactified, but it's just convenient to think of it as pi 1, and there is a point at infinity, which is the weak coupling cusp. And such elliptic vibration, in all cases that we consider and that I think that we know physically, have a section, so they're rational elliptic surfaces. And then we can write them in Weierstrass normal form. So just as a cubic in coordinate x and y, like this. And so this is a standard Weierstrass form, so you can bring any cubic into this form. So in that form, then you have the elliptic curve that is fibered over the U plane, right? Now at the generic point of the elliptic fibration, an elliptic curve is just a torus. So you can write it as a quotient of C by lattice, like this. Those will be the geometric period, omega A and omega D. Forgot to mention that the physical period are essentially some derivative. Well, if you integrate the physical period 1 with respect to U, you get the physical periods here. Now, any rational elliptic surfaces, if it's not trivially fibered, must have singular fibers on the base, pi 1, and the singular fibers arise when the discriminant of the curve vanishes. The allowed singular fibers of an elliptic fibration are well known. They're classified by Kodara long ago. In the case of rational elliptic surfaces, here there are just 20 possibilities. This is the Kodara notation. For my purpose, we can focus on the so-called IN singularities, but this type of singularity is, of course, well known to many of you in string theory, F theory, and so on. They have this ADE classification, and in particular to which Kodara singularities, which arise as Kleinian singularities in the rational elliptic surface, which you can then resolve, and the resolution is the shape of a Dynkin diagram, which corresponds to ADE algebras. So in particular, IN corresponds to some SUN symmetry. And I will focus on this, but actually it's a bit more than that here, because physically we will need to know a bit more about which kind of IN singularities we have. The question is, if you see an IN singularities, so if you have a single I1 singularities, the only physics is that there is a singularity in the description because there was a single electron or particle that became massless at this point. But if you have an IN singularities, there are several possibilities, because in general, it just means that the beta function of this low energy U1 is n. So that means that it could be either that there are n particles that became massless, or a single particle of charge square root of n that became massless, for instance, or anything in between. That will be important below. If in that case, where I have a single particle of square root of n that become massless, then this low energy theory has no flavor symmetry. So it has no mass I can deform with and so on. And so this will be what is called the undeformable singularity. Now, if I have an elliptic curve, a classic problem in mathematics is just to find its rational points, right? Like in this simple example here, I have a cubic and 3 and 10, x and y, 3 and 10 is the solution of this equation. And then there are an infinite number of solutions in that case, which are rational. It's a hard problem to find the solution in general. But we know quite a bit about those through, in particular, the Mordahl-Weil theorem. So in our case, since we have a one parameter vibration over the U-plane, the birational solution, I mean rational section, so it will be solution x of u and y of u of the Weierstrass equation, which are rational. So rational function in many cases polynomials in u. And then the Mordal-Weil theorem tells us that the number of rational, the group of rational sections, so because of the group law on the elliptic curve, those sections form a group. And the Mordal-Weil theorem tells us that it's an abelian group because it's an elliptic curve, but that is finitely generated. And so for any finitely generated abelian group, there will be a free part here, which is the number of free generators is the rank of the Mordal-Weil group. And most interesting for us today is that they could be torsion elements. So n torsion point just means a point where you add it n times to itself, you get the zero section of the elliptic curve. And I will do. If you think about the generic fiber and just map it to the plane, so an ordinary torus, complex torus, then, the addition law in that case is just the addition on the complex numbers. So for instance, the simple case that will be the case I will look at today, really, in the examples today, is you have a two section, so 2p equals 0. In that case, the only way to solve the Weierstrass equation is to put y equals 0. And so in that case, the right-hand side of the Weierstrass equation has to be 0. So it's a cubic, so that if there are either no rational solution or there are one or three solutions, right? So if there are one solution, it will be either this or this. So this is a Z2. You can add this point. You get back to the zero section, which is like the origin here. Or you could have Z2 times Z2, which is when there are three solutions, and they form this Z2 times Z2 group. Finally, I will be interested in isogenies today, which are homomorphism of elliptic curves. So thinking of the elliptic curve as an abelian group. You might have an homomorphism, so in particular, it preserves the zero section. The kernel of this isogeny is finite, and at the level of this complex torus here, that means that we preserve the origin here, and then it will correspond to essentially, mapping a bigger lattice to a smaller lattice with a certain kernel. So it's easier to just look at this example. If I have a two isogeny here, I can take a quotient, which is what the isogeny amount to in that case, by the translation by this Z2 isogeny. And in that case, this is my two isogenous curve here on the right. In general, I could have a rescaling of everything, and that will be important later. This alpha is if I just rescale. So this is the same elliptic curve, just the two periods rescaled by the same numbers. And it's important to note that this is the case on the general fiber, but if you have an isogeny of the rational elliptic surface, it's well known how this isogeny acts on all the singular fibers, the IN fibers in particular. It will either like divide IN or multiply it, depending on the fixed points of whatever. Okay, so back to physics. The last bit of information I need to review is that the Coulomb branch knows a bit the Seber-Witten solution knows a bit more than just the low energy Lagrangian. It also knows about the spectrum of BPS massive particles that can exist on the Coulomb branch. So those BPS particles in general are dionic, so the magnetic and electric charges. Let's call it this charge gamma. And they will sit in some lattice that will be a sublattice in general of all the SU2 charges, which are called by gamma here. Now, here we, in the Seber-Witten solution for the SU2 case, in fact, we can identify gamma, the dionic charges, with the homology lattice of the Seber-Witten curve. And then any dions, it's equivalent to specific gamma. I mean, it's equivalent to choosing a one cycle in the first homology. A one cycle, yes, of the curve, an element in the first homology. And then the Dirac pairing. So this lattice has a pairing, which is the Dirac pairing, and the Dirac pairing geometrically becomes just the homology pairing. And then, of course, if you know the Seba-Witten solution, so you know the A and A dual periods, then you know the central charges of any BTS particles by the central charge formula. All right, so now we know the image, so we can look again at this paper from 3 years ago, the second Seba-Witten paper, and this is the Seba-Witten curve. It's given very explicitly. Sorry, so this is the Seba-Witten curve in Drewer's transform, so completely explicitly in terms of U, and lambda is just lambda QCD, you could set it to 1. The important thing is that it has this discriminant, and so there are two singular points at U equal plus and minus lambda squared. The physics of that, of course, as we know, is that the monopole or the dyon become massless. This is the in the UV, this is just the Tov-Polyakov monopole from the Xing of C2 to U1, that then actually so it's one, it has mass over 1 over g squared in the weak coupling limit, but it actually becomes massless at strong coupling at this point. And similarly for the dyon, which in our normalization will have then charge minus 1, 2. And then this object here in the center is called the BPS quiver. It's obtained by just writing a blob for each light particles that become light at one or the other strongly coupled point, the Seba-Witten points, and write a number of arrows, which is given by the direct pairing. So in that case, between the monopole and the dyon, there is direct pairing 2. So there are 2 arrows. Those BPS quivers are useful because the full BPS spectrums can be then obtained everywhere in principle, well, almost, by looking at the operation theory of this quiver. In particular, here we see that any BPS states, both at weak and strong coupling, will have positive electric charge because it has to be a bound state of these simple objects. So all the allowed particles here in my gamma at SU2 will have even electric charge and bad notation, but this is M is electric charge and N is the magnetic charge. So this is what we will call the allowed charges today. Now the dynamic charge in principle for the SU2 theory where any M and Q of this form, so where in terms of the SU2 algebra would be this normalization. So this is the minimal magnetic. So this, when this is even, M is integer. So this is the minimal monopole in SU2 and the minimal charge for the quarks. And the allowed BPS lines are the wall volume then of the massive dyons. So in particular, it could be the Wilson line as we saw, which is a massive quark, external quarks. And so it just needs to be mutually local with all the dynamical BPS particles in the game. So this is the condition that the gamma L, so the gamma of the lines, should just be have an integer direct pairing with all the allowed charges. But in that case, this is just the statement that all the allowed charges are anything in my allowed by SU2, and which we said before was identified with the homology lattice of the Seba-Witten curve. So the only BPS line that cannot be screened, remember, was the Wilson line in this case, my 0-1 line. It is charged under a Z2 symmetry. So here in terms of the magnetic and electric charges, in blue is the Wilson line, in red are the dynamical particles in the spectrum, here in the weakly coupled spectrum, and that's it. And so there is a Z2 symmetry that acts on this Wilson line by a sign. Now, how do we see that at the level of the Seba-Witten curve? I mean, already the first question I had was just to identify the one-form symmetry. In this case, the fact that we have a Z2, it is related to the fact that if you look at the Mordahl-Weil group of the Seba-Witten curve, it's actually just a Z2. So there is a single generator, non-trivial generator, which should be identified with, in fact, the one-form symmetry, the generator of the one-form symmetry. So this is the statement here, something we discussed already in a paper with Oria in that case a few years ago. There's also some comment in some paper of Cecotti and Kersi that I'm not sure I agree or understand either way. Yeah, as an aside, this Coulomb branch for SU2 is also famously a modular curve that can be useful in very inexplicit computation. Modular curve means that the U-plane can be thought of as a quotient by a modular group. So in other words, there is a one-to-one, there is a parallelomorphism between the U-plane and the upper half-plane for the effective gauge coupling, where the modular group that gives a quotient in that case is gamma 0,4. And that will be the fundamental domain of gamma 0,4 that is then equivalent to the U-plane. So in particular, there are, from the point of view of this modular group, it has two cusps of width 1, which are precisely the monopole points and the end points on Seberwitten. So this is the explicit form of U as a function of tau in particular, which is the modular form for gamma 0,4 in that case. So using that picture in particular, it's particularly easy to find the monodromies along those points just from group theory, essentially. For instance, around the monopole points, it's a monodromy conjugated to T, which is the monodromy at infinity here, but then you do S transformation to get you there. Note that you can look at the width. So, well, roughly, picturally, the width is what you kind of see intuitively. It has a mathematical definition. But the width of the cusp is precisely the type IN, I1 or IN here in the elliptic vibration. So jumping ahead, let me extrapolate and just claim a few things about the general structure of rank 1 Seberwitten curve. The first thing is that the Seberwitten geometry of any absolute rank 1 theories will be given by a principally polarized rational elliptic surface, and then the line lattice is indeed identified with the homology lattice, exactly. Now, given such a theory, the discrete one-form symmetry will always be isomorphic to a subgroup of the Mordalval group of the mass deformed theory in general. But yeah, it will be always a subgroup of the Mordalval group, that's true. Which subgroup, we will get to it in a second when we consider more examples. So there are a few heuristic arguments for that, but they're only heuristic, but maybe the simplest one is that if you consider a la Seberwitten in 96, the theory on R3 times S1, then you would get Kaluza-Klein 4DN equal, 3DN equal 4 theory of Kaluza-Klein type, which then will have an hyperkeller Coulomb branch, and this hyperkeller Coulomb branch will be the total space of the Seberwitten vibration in that case. And so we also know that if you had a one-form symmetry in 4D, it will become a one-form and a zero-form symmetry, which is spontaneously broken in the 3D Coulomb branch, and that will act as a translation then on the Coulomb branch. So that's one reason why you would expect that indeed those torsion translation on the fiber will be identified with one-form symmetries. But as we'll see, it's a bit more subtle than that. So in general, it's only a subgroup of the torsion element, which is the one-form symmetry. Okay, so my second big question for today was just to consider the gauging. So what is the Seberwitten curve then for the SO3 theory when I gauge this one-form symmetry? So a natural guess is then to look at the isogenous curve generated by this, I wrote before the section. So in that case, it is this red dot again on the generic fiber. And so the natural guess is that, okay, I just look at this new curve, which is too isogenous. Is that the SO3 theory? Well, let's see. So you do this to isogeny, then you have this smaller curve here in red, but this will be convenient. I mean, in fact, it is necessary to rescale everything by square root of 2. This is what I do here, the square root of 2 here. So if you do that, then you can compute easily the new periods, right? In particular, you get the dual period here is just half of what it was before, and then you rescale everything by square root of 2. So in that case, tau prime is tau over 2, the new gauge coupling, and you can see dually the charge transform. So you see that the charge in this new description is the square root of 2 factor. This is important, the square root of 2, because that's necessary to preserve the direct pairing. So if you want to have the same BPS spectrum, and all of this story, the BPS spectrum, which is really about the local information, should not care. The spectrum itself should not care which global form of the theory you chose. So the direct pairing better be the same in particular. But then, as a result, what happened is that the new Sabahutan curve that we get here after this isogeny is not principally polarized. So the polarization is essentially our choice of direct pairing, and it will be related by square root of 2 to the homology lattice pairing. So this is explicitly then including the square root of 2 factor, the new curve, which I call the relative curve for the SU2 algebra, if you wish. So that's the relative curve. This discriminant is as follows. So now it has two singularities, at lambda squared and minus lambda squared. But because of the factor of 2 here, those are so-called type 2 singularity, which is related to the fact that there is a square root of 2 charge here, as we said before. So it's an I2 singularity, so you have a square root of 2 electron, an electron of square root of 2 charge. Okay, maybe that's not bad, but that's just what it is. There is a square root of 2 we need to take into account. But so it's not principally polarized. So up to this square root of 2 rescaling, in fact, this curve is also, it was the very first that appeared historically in the first paper of Semer-Witten. If you again look at it as a modular domain, it will be a gamma 2 curve, where there are again two cusps of width 2 in this case for the gamma 2 group. That's the fundamental group of the fundamental domain for gamma 2. A note for the expert and a well-known fact that we'll get back to, but this curve that I just wrote is isomorphic also to the masses curve of SU2 with two flavors, but very different physically, and the physical difference is that my I2 singularities here are non-deformable. Well, if you look at massless SU2 with two flavors, the I2s can be split further by turning masses for the quarks. Now let's look then at the rational section of this relative curve. The modulable group in this case is Z2 plus Z2. So it's generated by those three rational sections, which are the three roots of the right-hand side of the Weierstrass form of the cubic. So this is this form. And then we could see, again, perform isogeny from this and see what happens if I do any of the quotient by Z2. So if I quotient in that direction, then I got back where I started. In fact, whenever I have an isogeny, there exists a dual isogeny that gets me where I started up to a kernel, up to a rescaling, really. I could quotient in vertically here, and then that will be what we will call in a second, what will be the SO3 plus curve. And there is the diagonal thing that I didn't write here, but it will be something like this. If you quotient by the diagonal Z2, then you get the SO3 minus curve. So here, my second general claim is that if you look at Sabahutan curve for relative theories, which are not principally polarized, then the defect group is identified with the modulable Weyl torsion. So the modulable torsion is not a one-form symmetry because that doesn't make sense from the point of view of the relative theory. But as we said, if you have the relative theory, the natural object is to look at the defect group, and it's just encoded in the rational section here. All right, so then let's do this last step, and let's look at the SO3 theory here. So you can do the isogeny completely explicitly. By the way, I mean, there are formulas called Velu formula to write the new Weierstrass form for along any n isogeny. So that's what it looks like. Okay, and so it looks a bit more messy, but that's just an explicit expression. You can easily compute the discriminant. And now it has two, it is still has, of course, two Sabahutan singularities, but now of type I1. And so for SO3 plus and minus, that just differ by some sign of lambda squared here. And it has then two singularities, but of type I1, and type I4 here. And of course, the two SO3 and SO3 plus and minus curves are related by shifting the theta angle, as we said. But shifting the theta angle by 2 pi is just shifting the sign of lambda squared here. So that's OK. So we can again look at the BBS quivers. But now in the SO3 normalization, the monopole, the same monopole as before, but now in the SO3 normalization, it has charge 2, right? My Tov-Polyakov monopole, it has magnetic charge 2 in the SO3. Normalization, and we get that for free here by just doing the isogeny. And similarly, the dyon will have charge, this is wrong, there is no square root of 2 here, but it's minus 2, okay, There's a typo there. Anyway, it's in the paper. And similarly, the monopole here will be 2 minus 1 for the SO3 minus curve. You can get from there by doing shifting by 2 pi and take into account the Witten effect. But the important thing is that, of course, the direct pairing is preserved. You have the same spectrum and so on. And this is the relation between the SO3 plus and minus and SU2 charges like this. The fundamental domain, again, it has a nice modular expression. The Coulomb branch can be written as a fundamental domain for gamma 0,4 with a 0 down here, actually. And this will be SO3 plus and SO3 minus. It has a width one cusp here and a width 4 cusp here. Note that, again, this is the same curve as the massless curve for SU2 with 3 quarks, with NF equal 3, except that, of course, now the I4 is undeformable. So it's a single monopole of charge 2. Right. So now let's look at the Mordaval group of this SO3 curve. It has an interesting Mordaval group because now it's not Z2 anymore, it's Z4. So this is the explicit form of the section that generates the Z4. Then if you do, there is a normal subgroup, which is 2 times the generator of Z4, it's a Z2. This Z2 will be the one-form symmetry. But there is this non-trivial group extension, so there is a normal subgroup and the co-kernel here. And so the full Mordaval group is Z4. So yeah, so we identify again, as we said, a particular subgroup as the one-form symmetry. In fact, there you know what it is because you start from, let's say, the SU2 theory. We'll see in the picture in the end. But because you know that you come from the relative curve, you know what is the dual isogeny that you came from, and that will be precisely the one-form symmetry generator. But this dual isogeny now is extended to a Z4, in fact. So what is the interpretation? It's quite interesting. That's something actually not in our paper, but something we should update the archive soon at some point. So what is the interpretation? If you look again at the generic fiber, this is what the Z4 looks like. So this is the generator. 2 times the generator is a Z2. Again, if we quotient by the Z2, I go back to the relative curve. But if I quotient by the Z4, I get this smaller curve. We always need to rescale by square root of the degree of the isogeny, n in that case, so 4. So here we rescale everything by 2. And so in this process, we get from the SO3 plus to the SO3 minus curve. Right? So doing a 4 isogeny get me from SO3 plus to SO3 minus, or vice versa. But we saw also that if I were just shifting lambda squared by to minus lambda squared, so shifting the theta angle, then I also go from SO3 plus to SO3 minus. So there are 2 distinct ways of going to SO3 plus to SO3 minus. So if you combine them, then it looks like a symmetry of the curve itself. And indeed, then there is a natural interpretation. The point is that if you look from if you start from the SU2 theory, it has actually a Z8 R symmetry that includes a Z2 subgroup which was spontaneously broken on the Coulomb branch. And this spontaneously broken R symmetry in the SU2 theory exchanges the dyon and the monopole points so that they're both completely physically equivalent. In the SO3 theory, this is not true. In fact, just from the UV, you can see that this R symmetry, this Z2 R symmetry, doesn't exist anymore. And then the two monopole and dyon points are not physically equivalent. Indeed, in one case, we saw that we had charge 2 particles, while here this is minus 2, 1 or something up to. But anyway, it's SL2Z orbit of 1, 0, while this is twice the charge. So they're clearly physically different. In fact, you can then deform to super Young mills, like in several written paper. You give a mass to 4d n equal 1. Then you look at the massive vacua that arises from each super Witten singularity. In SU2, you have 2 vacua which are physically equivalent, also in 4d super Young mills, 2 gap vacua. But in SO3, I studied in particular in the paper of Aaron Iseberg and Tachikawa, the n equal 1 super Young mills from the monopole points, let's say for SO3 plus, will also have a Z2 TQFT that arises because when you do the n equal 1 deformation, you X the dual photon. But here, because it's at charge 2, it remains a Z2 gauge field, right? So you get you still have 2 gap vacua, but the global form of the group arises because the the gap vacua is actually non-trivially gaps in the sense that there is a Z2 symmetry on one in one vacuum and not the other. And so there is no symmetry between the two. So this is all encoded in the in this Abelian curve. So that's why we needed to have an I1 and an I4. But the fact that we started with one theory and then gauged the one form symmetry and we lost this Z2 R symmetry, this zero form symmetry, means that we had an anomaly to start with, as studied by Cordova and Dimitrescu in the first, in some detail, I think. And it's precisely of this type. So the anomaly between those one form and zero form is a five dimensional TQFT like this. When you gauge, if you have some anomaly and then gauge one form symmetry, so this is B is the background gauge field for the one form symmetry here. We know on general ground, so from this paper of Kadi, Omori, and Zeng, that this Z2 zero form symmetry do not completely disappear in the SO3 theory, but will just become a non-invertible symmetry. So it's a Z2 non-invertible. I mean, it's not a Z2, but it's non-invertible so that if you take it twice, in that case, you get a sum of generator of the one form symmetry. So the claim here is that this four isogeny that we had above combine with the shift of the theta angle. So it sends them the SO3 plus curve to the SO3 plus curve. So it's a symmetry. And it's kind of the imprint of this non-invertible UV theory into the IR infrared Sabirabutan description, right? So that is the proposal. And that are, you can argue that that's the case by, for example, looking at how the dyon are transformed by this transformation. In particular, it would sense dyons to non-genuine lines, genuine lines to non-genuine lines. To summarize this SU2-SO3 story, here is the picture from the beginning. So really, in all those cases, and I'll flash some more examples in a second, we need to first know what is the relative curve. And from the relative curve, you can get everything by isogenies. So in that case, this is my SU2 relative curve with two I2 singularities. There was a Z2 plus Z2 torsion, which was identified with the defect group. And then picking a global form corresponds to looking at a Lagrangian subgroup that corresponds to then doing isogenies along this Lagrangian subgroup. And then you get the SU2 curve, or the SO3 plus curve, or the SO3 minus curve. Yeah. Any questions on this? So, by the way, historically, this is the first Sabirabutan curve This was in the second paper. This is what Sabirabutan obtained as the limit of SQCD when you go NF equals zero. And they have a footnote somewhere that those two are two isogenies, but of course, there was no clear meaning of this isogeny. Here, what I insisted on is rescaling this curve by square root of 2, and then there is this natural physical things that you do when you interpret the middle one as relative and then pick the global form. So that also means that if I want to gauge the one-form symmetry, what I need to do is just start from there and then do two isogenies. But of course, there could be several ways. I can gauge like this and like this. As we know, there are not one SO3 theory, but two different ones in this case. So another cute example is the SU2 n equal 2 star. So that's SU2 n equal 4 super young males with a mass deformation for the adjoint hypermultiplet. And in that case, there is also a relative curve. And then in that case, there is a single absolute curve, which is completely similar to this. Of course, if you this is SU2 with an adjoint. If you give a large mass to the adjoint, you should get back to this picture. But if you have the adjoint, then there is also S-duality that comes from S-duality of n equal 4. So that exchanges the SU2 to SO3 picture and SO3 minus like this. So this is actually the Sabirabutan curve historically that was also in the second Sabirabutan paper. It has three I2 singularities, right? So then there is natural SL2Z action. But actually, the S-duality that acts on the UV coupling here, so these things are now depends on the UV gauge coupling, those curves. It's actually a gamma 2 subgroup of SL2Z that is the actual S-duality group, and that acts on the absolute curve non-trivially like this. So in particular, you can see that the SU2 frame If I have a large mass, then the I4 will go towards infinity, because the I4 singularity there is just the correspond to the, it's the point where the adjoint become massless, right? Where the U parameter cancel the mass of the adjoint. And then this is the SU2 Sebewithen curve. Well, here this is my SO3 curve, because in SO3 normalization, the adjoint was just an I1 singularity. Okay. But yeah, so in that case, it works nicely in the same way. So yeah, so you have some time then to discuss slightly more exotic theories, which are 5D SCFTs, also of rank one. So we know that in 5D, there exist some strongly coupled conformal field theories, which have no Lagrangian description whatsoever. But yeah, they still have the same H supercharges. So in particular, I could compactify them on a circle and get an effective 4D n equal 2 description, which is what I want to do now. So the rank 1 5D SCFT are conjecturally classified. I mean, you have to take any classification with a grain of salt in string theory things, but at least people think that from all the way we know to construct such theories, we know only 10 or 11 of them, which is listed here. But only two of these 11 theories have a non-trivial one-form symmetry, and so there is a notion of a different global forms, which is what I want to consider today. These are the so-called E0 and E1 theory. So those 5D SCFTs can be deformed by a relevant operator that then can flow to a five-dimensional description, which is infrared free in terms of 5D gauge fields. And so this E1 is also called the SU2 theory, because it looks in some mass deformation as an SU2 gauge theory, while the E0 has no such Lagrangian-like description at all. But either way, the E1 theory has a Z2 one-form symmetry, and the E0 has a Z3 one-form symmetry in five dimension. Now, if you compactify this theory on a circle, then if you have a Z10 one-form symmetry in 5D, then you will get a Zn one-form symmetry in 4D, but also a Z0 one-form symmetry that you just obtain because, for instance, the charge line becomes a particle because it wraps a circle. So also, if I gauge a one-form symmetry in five dimension, then I get a dual two-form symmetry, which then in 4D will give a two-form and a one-form symmetry. So in 4D language, then I have both a one-form and zero-form symmetry, so I should be able to gauge one or the other. So I start with something with a one-form and zero-form symmetry. I gauge a one-form symmetry. I get these theories, or I get the zero-form symmetry, and maybe the diagram commute. Hopefully, the diagram commute. And then these things at the bottom would be the circle reduction of the 5D theory with the dual two-form symmetry that you obtain by gauging the 5D one-form symmetry. So this should commute or should exist if indeed the one-form symmetry that you want to gauge in 5D is non-anomalous, because 5D one-form symmetry can actually have cubic anomalies. So it would be a 5D TQFT, which is roughly a cubic in the two-form gauge field, background gauge field for the one-form symmetry. And it's known from arguments in geometric engineering, essentially, that indeed the E1 theory is non-anomalous, while the E0 theory has a cubic anomaly for the one-form symmetry. So we would like to check whether our picture, our analysis, bears this out. So for the E1 theory, so as I said, it's like a 5D SU2 gauge theory, so it should be closely related. And in fact, in some limit, it will give, again, the SU2 superangular description of before. And indeed, we find those four theories like this. So this is obtained by doing isogeny, gauging along the isogeny, as I said before, reading between the sections, while gauging the zero-form symmetry, just a discrete, those are spontaneously broken symmetry on the 4D Coulomb branch. So we essentially quotient this Coulomb branch by this spontaneously broken symmetry. So you can study again the BPS states and so on in this from looking at the Sebewithen solution. There is a nice BPS quivers that have been studied in various, some of my older papers and in various perspectives. One nice thing is that those 5D theories will have, you know, it's a 5D gauge theory in some limit, and then it becomes essentially two copies of SU2 theory in some limit. And in particular, then you can see subquivers, which are the SU2, the pure SU2 BPS quivers, but then it has more structure because of all the 5D particles. So yeah, we can look at all these theories. The details don't matter, but anyway, it's similar to what we had before. This is if you gauge one-form symmetry, there will be the analog of the SU2 theory, which is this guy here, and the analog of the SO3 theories, SO3 plus and minus theories, which is this guy here. So this is this line here. So when you do the one-form gauging, you need to go through a relative curve here, which is this blue guys. But yeah, so you see that in some ways it looks like double copies of SU2 theories when for generic 5D masses, this lambda. And at strong coupling in 5D, which is lambda equal 1, then some of the I1 singularity collide from an I2, which is deformable. There is a X branch that arises there and so on. But so you can gauge one-form symmetry and you get these pictures. So this is all nice and consistent. And of course, you can then further deform and get back to what I explained before if you take a 4D scaling limit. Now, if I gauge the zero-form symmetry, then I get slightly more exotic type of curves, but that's what they are. And so in particular, this structure here, so this is the generic mass and this is strong coupling in 5D, would be what is the, if you want, the 5D SO3 theory on the circle, the one with the two-form symmetry in 5D that you reduce on the circle. So these things are the two-form and the one-form symmetry in 4D language. For the E0 theory, we similarly have a relative and absolute curve here, but and then you can again gauge the Z3 one-form symmetry in the same way. So here there is a Z3 plus Z3 modal-val group, and then you can take any of the four subgroups of Z3 plus Z3. And this is what it is. But this will be the theory I start with, kind of the electric theory, which I said had an anomaly, a cubic anomaly in 5D, which become a mixed anomaly between the zero form and the one form symmetry in 4D. And so it should be that if I gauge the one form symmetry, I lose the Z3 zero form symmetry that I see in the 4D description. So gauging would again follow an isogeny from here to here, for instance. And here you see that there is an obvious Z3 spontaneously broken symmetry of my whole subarbitrary geometry, which here is doesn't exist anymore. And that's the sign of the anomaly in 5D. So that's interesting. Final quick comment about the M-strings, because this is really the mother theory of all the theories I discussed today. You can look at the A1-6D 2-0 theories on the torus, and then you can further turn a sort of flat connection that will deform to a 6D 1-0 that will, in some limit, become the adjoint of an equal 2 star that we had before. I saw last night that Sergei Gukov gave a talk a few weeks ago where he was asking you the question about whether the A1 theory on a torus is an equal 4, and he said, no, it's not. And indeed, in general, it's this guy, what sometimes people call the M-string. And only in some scaling limit, you will get the N equal 4 superhanging Emils. In fact, yes, you see it has many more singularities. This is, again, the electric theory, the relative curve. Relative curve looks simpler, right? Because it's just a bunch of six I2 singularities, while here you have this more double structure of, essentially, it looks like two copies of SU2 N equal 2 stars, sorry. But again, here now we have the SO3 version and so on, but now there is still the kind of S-duality, which is just the SL2Z transformation of the compactification torus. But you can then gauge the zero-form symmetry, and this is what happens when you gauge the zero-form symmetry in the 4D description. And finally, as a kind of byproduct of this carefully analyzing those, we just realize that something that's not been analyzed much or at all, but that we can identify also a BPS quiver for this M-string theory in 4D, which is quite nice. It has essentially, again, two copies of the N equal 2 star quiver, which is a triangle with two arrows like this and this, but now, you know, there are many ways to slice it, and related to S-duality, that there are so many ways to slice it. So clearly that's, in some completely unrelated work with Michele Del Zotto and some of his students, we started studying that, and it passes quite a few consensus checks. But
gammas are not going all in the same direction, I guess. I assume this is intentional, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's just what you find explicitly. So the way you do that is that you look at any of those descriptions, even the relative one, if you want, with square root of 2, whatever, and you look at the BPS pair, so you can identify the BPS charge for all of those singularity, and that's it. So we have a simple object for each separated singularity, and this is the BP, the direct pairing between all those states.
Is this the BPS pair one that you would use to make a K3? Or am I confused? I'm totally confused.
I mean, those are all the BPS particles that you would get by looking at the 6Z theory in a torus, but I don't know if...
I don't remember in this CP1 with the additive vibration, it's the same as the one for K3, I forget.
I'm not sure.
like kind of an interesting application of the.
Yeah. I mean, I should note that this BPS quiver, from the way we're doing it, just looking at the direct pairing on the Coulomb branch, it might not give all the information needed about the spectrum, because it's quite possible, in fact, likely, that there will be also some non-trivial superpotential, and I don't know how to identify it in this language. So, yeah. All right, so to summarize, what we explained in this paper was a systematic understanding of the global structure of rank one, for the n equal 1 theories, for the n equal 2 theories, sorry, from the Sebrewitten geometry. And so we can summarize as by three conjecture, if you will, physics conjecture. The first one is that if you have a relative rank 1 theory, it should be a non-principally polarized elliptic curve. And then the Mordahl-Weil group for the massiform curve. Massiform is that in general you might need to consider generic mass deformation if such mass exists, like in an equal to star. Then the Mordahl-Weil group, in that case, the torsion part of the Mordahl-Weil group is identified with the defect group. And then from there, you can start taking subgroup, as we said, Lagrangian subgroup, and describe a global form or absolute forms of the rank one theory. So the absolute curves would be principally polarized elliptic curves. And in that case, then the line lattice of the principally polarized elliptic curve is the homology lattice of the curve, and the one-form symmetry then is a subgroup of the torsion part of the Mordahl-Weil group. But the way to identify the subgroup is to just start from here and do the isogeny. The dual isogeny will be the one that would generate the dual isogeny is the one-form symmetry. And then that means that gauging one-form symmetry just composing two isogenies, right? So we also hinted, in particular, in the SO3 curve as further structure. It seems like things like non-invertibles, and in some other related earlier work, we saw that in some cases there could also be two group structure that seems to have a shadow in those rational sections of the Sebrewitten curve. But that's certainly something that would be nice to study further. I mean, here essentially we consider all the rank one curves that exist. So really, for future work, the thing we really need to do is go to higher rank. Now, at higher rank, the tools that I use today are useless. You should really probably directly think about the Abelian variety of period. And there are fewer results also about isogenies and so on those things. So in those cases, even if you look at pure SUN, in fact, for pure SUN, there is just a single, in generic, maybe two, I think there is a single curve on the market, the one first written. Written in many ways, but for instance, derived from SQCD by Witten. But this curve looks very much, I mean, for sure, it's what I would call the relative curve. And so there should be a notion of absolute curve. And for SUN, of course, there should be many global forms that we should be able to write by following some isogenies. I think that Argyres and collaborator have some work in progress on that, at least for n equal 4. But clearly there is more work to do. And finally, one thing that we did in earlier work with Aurea, but didn't complete for sure, and would be very interesting also at higher rank, is to have a physics proof of this kind of conjecture and understanding of global form, by which I mean in the context of 5D theories and physics theory in particular, the way we understand those theories is really from string theory. One clean way, for instance, is looking at those 5D theories from M theory, Calabi-Yau-Tree singularities in M theory. And then putting it on a circle, we get a Calabi-Yau-Tree in type 2A. And the global structure corresponds to really boundary conditions for, the defects come from both brains and NS5 brain and fundamental strings that are wrapped on the Calabi-Yau-Tree fold. And so all this global structure, in particular for 5D SCFTs, will be boundary condition, not only for the deep brain structure, which you kind of understand or can study probably from using the topological B-string, but you also need to, for the thing I discussed today, also introduce NF5 brain and fundamental, like the thing charged under the B field as well. So for that, not much at all has been done. So clearly there is more work to do in that direction. So thank you for your attention.
Any questions? And observations. So I agree with the same that, so you refer to the Sebrewitten curve here, but probably you won't talk about the fiber of the Sebrewitten integral system.
Yeah.
So these rational points form sort of sections of these subroutine systems, right?
Yeah.
So now they're defined not for just a single value view, but
they're really global objects, yeah.
And the effect of the result of sections of the each vibration is we're talking about surface defects.
Mm-hmm.
Usually surface defects give you sort of very wiggly sections. Because they have interesting couplings on how they're encoded in the shape of the sections. But it's sort of straight sections might correspond to topological surface defects, which might be sort of Dirac strings if you touch two lines, maybe it can be useful.
I see.
Perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, indeed, also in from this picture, I mean, to go to higher rank, certainly one more systematic way might be to indeed think in terms of the HN system and also relatively the relation to 3D. I mean, I saw that in your paper with Moore and Inchke, you had this very brief section on isogenous HN system related to this question of SO3 and SU2 and so on, but...
Right, there's this confusing story. The curves, the fibers for a true theory want to be self-dual abelian varieties.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the Hitchin system for the SU2 or SO3, it's almost never as dual.
Yeah.
That was either a bit too big or too short. No. And so these theories seem to be like the sort of ambient things with the big, too big.
The one that has too much, yeah, absolutely.
So I think that this discussion should totally work at higher rank.
Yes, indeed. So for instance, in the case of n equal to star, it was this thing, right? And this is the relative curve. It has those three I2s. There is an explicit SL2Z that acts and that rotates those. But the absolute curve instead is this guy, right? Yeah.
Any other questions? Thank you, Spirit, again.
Thanks.